Welcome to our 24th episode of the Transportation Management Podcast. Today's topic is the trigger concept in transportation management. My name is Thomas Quintus. I'm a developer in the freight order management team.
Hello, my name is Gustav Zoll. I joined TM IMS team this year. My main area is the freight order management.
Hello, my name is Tina German. I'm an intern in the development team freight order management.
Yeah, my name is Bernd Dittrich. I'm also in the freight order management team. I'm a happy developer of the affected developer of the trigger report as well. And I do the recording today. Okay. What is today's topic? What are we talking about?
So today's topic is the trigger concept in general, specifically trigger report. Is the MTMS process trigger BGD for background. We will come to that later. That is supposed to resolve all the triggers that were created in the system.
So okay, that's it for today then, right? Or should we explain a bit more?
Yeah, what's the trigger concept? Trigger concept in TM is the main tool to enable a kind of loose coupling between documents. For example, the easiest example is if you have a forwarding order, which is already planned on a freight order, and somebody locks the freight order in edit mode, for example, and somebody else tries to change the forwarding order. What should happen? We decided in the beginning with TM80 that the blocking of the freight order should not disallow somebody else to change the forwarding order because, yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can go a bit into history for that, why we went that way. Because in TM60 and 70, rest in peace, we didn't have such a triggered concept at all. And okay, and that time we also had a lot of business objects. So we had the TRQ, no, SRQ, and freight units, and PTAs, and a lot of different objects involved. And now, if a change came in, for example, from ERP, we had an update in the TRQ, SRQ in that time, which then made an update in the freight unit, which then made an update in the PTA, which then made an update in the TOR and the freight order at that time. What was it called? Tour at that time. And that, or shipment order was even a bit later there. And then this shipment order was locked. So now the whole transaction was basically broken. So we had to roll back everything. At that time, we had a so-called Abfangjäger, so stealth fighter or so, which then, if we discovered such a locking issue, the complete transaction dumped to be complete. So I think that was one of the parents or reasons why we decided to decouple, because if you at the very end find out that there's something that you should have locked at the beginning but you haven't, then you have an issue to have a consistent transaction. And on the other hand, if you lock everything very early, so you go into the forwarding order and you could affect the invoice later that you send to your carrier, so let's say five documents later in the doc chain, then you very often block your complete system without even need to do so. And then nobody could really work. I think that is a bit of history behind also.
So that means since 8.0, everything is much simpler.
Of course.
Okay, so then let's assume somebody tries to change a forwarding order. Yeah. What we will do when changing a forwarding order, we will try to lock the freight unit as before. So if you cannot lock the freight unit, you're not allowed to change the forwarding order. So there's a strong coupling between these two documents. But let's assume the freight unit is not locked. So when changing the forwarding order, you can lock the freight unit. But the freight order is still locked. We want to allow this process. So what will happen is you will change your forwarding order. The change will be propagated to the freight unit. the system realizes that the freight order cannot be updated, so it will create a trigger for this and then do the normal save. This is the simplest case of creating a trigger. Freight order is already locked by somebody. Forwarding order will be changed by somebody else, and the propagation is, so to say, stored on a database table, which has to be resolved later by some mechanism.
So the propagation, for example, of quantities of the item
or times or whatever.
Okay.
So for this, in the time frame between saving the forwarding order and resolving the issue with the trigger, these two documents, forwarding order and freight order, are not completely synchronized, let's say. They are only synchronized if you consider in the whole picture the existence of the trigger that has been created in the meantime. So what is this trigger? This trigger is simply a picture of the action that should have been called on the freight order if that had been possible at that point in time. So the system basically takes the action that propagates the change and dumps all the context data of this action into a database entry and stores that.
Okay. So, but basically, I think it's important to know that in principle, only the necessity of that action is stored. You said you save the context data, but I think what also can happen is that I change the forwarding order and change the quantity from 10 to 20. And then the freight order is locked. And 5 minutes later, the freight order is still locked, optimizer run or something. And I change it again back to 10 or 11 or something. And then, okay, it's still locked. So we again come into that trigger processing, right? And I think for that, it's important to know that we would not store the data. We don't write down, okay, it's now 20 or something, but we just say, okay, freight order or in that example, follow-up document, you need to update yourself from the predecessor.
Yes.
Or vice versa, if the TRQ is locked and the planning status of the freight unit has been changed, meanwhile, dear TRQ, please check your overall life cycle status. So it's, so to say, stateless. I think that's important to know. And that's why also the sequence of the triggers doesn't matter, because there's normally, hopefully, always, the trigger only runs, or the processing the trigger only runs then on the current situation, which is then...
But yeah. I guess if we would have stored the context as well, so the action parameters, the trigger report would also use these parameters, then it would execute the action. But if the action doesn't have the parameter, then...
But this depends. In the end, everything depends on the implementation of the action. If the action simply tells the freight order, please do an update for all your items from the corresponding freight unit items, then this is okay. This is a good action that can be handled by the trigger concept. But instead, if you have a not so nice action which stores some concrete values in the parameters, then this is a bad example for the trigger report. In standard, all these actions behave nicely. So in the example of a quantity change in a forwarding order item, for example, we store the action for the freight order, which tells the freight order to take all the current data from the freight unit. So independent of what happened to these freight unit items in the meantime.
Because otherwise you would have that sequencing problem. You also would update, let's say, in my example, you would have two updates and the, let's say, intermediate update would not really be relevant. I mean, of course, that's also important to consider if we talk about something like the change controller in the freight order then, right? Because then I have one change and another, so to say, change back in the freight order. And depending on when this trigger runs, of course, the delta would be different, right? If the trigger report would have picked that trigger before the second change, then I would have a change from 10 to 20. And then if I change back from to 11, I said, right? Then again back from 20 to 11. So that's why I think now we can maybe come to that report a bit. The recommendation is also to process that triggers frequently, often, like.
Of course, it depends on your concrete situation, but obviously, if you have a lot of changes which cannot be processed because you have a lot of locked documents, then the number of triggers will be higher than in other situations where you hardly have any changes, for example. So that's why we wrote down in our application operations guide that the recommendation from SAP is to schedule this trigger report as a background job every 10 minutes. So it should run 6 times an hour, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year.
And okay, Christmas might be an exception, but otherwise.
Very important, it should run from the very beginning. So before you start any activities in your system, one of the first things should be that you schedule this background job. Otherwise, you will start already with a huge number of triggers in your database. Mm-hmm. And this means that,
the job takes
long time to finish.
And not only that, it also means that your freight orders, for example, not up to date. So you would still work on the wrong quantities there.
So clear recommendation is to run this every 10 minutes as a guideline. You might change this to something more frequently or less frequently, depending on your situation. But our experience is that 10 minutes is quite okay.
Because the good thing is also that it then that does some mass processing. So all triggers, so let's say all updates for 100 freight orders are processed together, and that is typically also a performance gain. Okay, maybe coming back to the trigger creation in more detail, I think, or did we cover? Yes. Okay, the overall process is I come into a situation where I create a trigger, which is, for example, for locking. I think we come a bit later also to other examples. Then I dump something into a database. We come to that details also later. And then I have that report. You already mentioned the name, right? CMTMS.
Trigger process BTD.
BTD. And I run it. Not talking about the parameters yet. And then everything is up to date again. Everybody happy, table empty. Okay. I think that's the 10,000 feet perspective.
This is the ideal case.
On the trigger. Okay, maybe we can now dive a bit deeper on when and also maybe technically how are triggers generated. We already mentioned the locking issue, but I think there are also other cases.
The typical case is that you create a trigger because of a locked document. So in the case of updating, freight unit tries to update a subsequent freight order. It would call the action for do follow-up documents. This in turn will ask the freight order to call the action update from related TORS, which is the freight unit in that case. If this is not possible because the freight order is locked, the update from related TORS action of the freight order will be stored as a trigger in the database table, together with the whole context in which this action was called. So, for example, if this happens in a mass process, for example, because you started from a POWL or something like that, we will store this action call together with the whole set of keys for which this action should have been called. This is important because we will generate for each freight order a trigger. Let's say we are dealing with 100 freight orders at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we will get 100 triggers, but these 100 triggers will share the same context because they have been called at the same point in time. It's the same action. There are other situations where we create trigger without having locked documents for asynchronous follow-up processes, where we don't want to deal immediately with propagation. So temporarily, we store them also as triggers, and let them be executed by the next run of the hopefully scheduled background job.
And technically, where and how do we store it?
Well, there are two database tables, as you might have guessed. The first table is the trigger header, where we store basically the key. So it's the GUID of the affected document. In our example of this 100 freight orders, we will store 100 entries, each having the GUID of one of the freight orders. And we
table
have,
name?
Table name is SCMTMS TRIGHD, trigger header.
D underscore?
D underscore TRIGHD.
Okay.
And there is a child table, the context table, SCMTMS D underscore TRIGCX, which stores the context. So in our case, the trigger header will get 100 new entries and the trigger context table will get one new entry.
Because all of
the
them...
The link is done by a foreign key. A GUID in the attribute part of the header table referring to the key field of the context table. And the context table basically consists of a long string which contains the whole context of the action call in compressed form. So this is done via a ABAP statement ABAP in the ABAP, in the buffer.
Convert to buffers, then
export to
buffer. Like a big blob, right?
Yeah. So basically, you can't see anything if you check the contents of this table. You don't have a clue what this is about. You can see only in the header table what the key is of the affected document, and you have the trigger ID, the other important field, which tells you something about to which action this trigger might be related. The trigger ID is not exactly a one-to-one relationship to the action. The action itself is only available in the context part of the context table, of course. But for readability, this trigger ID gives its speaking name almost, gives you an idea which action is still pending for a certain freight order, for example.
Okay. And so do we have some examples for that trigger IDs?
Yeah, I mean, the famous names are TRQ, aggregate lifecycle status, or do follow up tour, or something. This is a system table, SCMTMS I trig ID. You can see the contents there. They are also available as constants in the trigger constant interface.
And only those can be used for a trigger, yes. Right? So, yeah. So I would take away from that. So if you listen to that episode and you never heard about an unlikely case, you never heard about that trigger concept and report before, you check your table and it is empty, hopefully, right? So that is this trigger header. Table should be empty. Otherwise, we come to that later.
But if the trigger header table is empty, then the trigger context table should be empty as well. Yeah. If not, then there is a small report which is able to clean up the context table.
And we will give that report name in the show notes, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, if you see your application operations guide, there's also a link to a consulting note where all these small helpers are mentioned.
Okay. Yeah, we also can cross-reference that note. Okay, so that is the first case, how triggers can get generated when the document is locked, right? I think the second reason can be that you intentionally don't want to update, for example, the booking, right? I think the we'll elaborate on that a bit, or should I?
Yeah, I mean, it's simply a way to postpone subsequent actions, just to finish something earlier. You store it explicitly as a trigger with the disadvantage that you have a certain delay but with the advantage that it's separated. So it technically it works exactly the same way as the trigger concept for locked documents. Yeah, it's okay. just another way of using this concept.
Example would be, I think, in the air booking, we did it first for the air booking, that somebody signs a forwarding order to the air booking. That, of course, if you directly assign it there, the air booking would be locked and nobody else could assign it at the time. And also the people responsible for the bookings could not enter it because it's locked by user then. And I think to address that, we introduced in the booking type customizing parameter, which is direct update or asynchronous update allowed or so, something like that. It's in the lower right corner of the customizing, if I remember right. And with that, you can kind of treat that booking as if it would be locked. So if I assign a forwarding order to that booking or remove it, then instead of trying to assign it to the booking first and then only go to the trigger mode if it fails because of locking, it directly creates a trigger entry and then the next batch will pick it up so that you don't, yeah, that's more also decoupling between the different organization units and last changed by kind of things and but mainly the locking thing that then is, because once you touch an object in BOP until you save, then again, it depends on the transaction mode. The document will remain locked. So if you assign it and then you continue working in your forwarding order, the booking will be locked and locked and locked. Not only at the moment where you assign it, but the whole transaction. I think that's why we use that also for that purpose. And I think there's one more freestyle way. I think we did it with a customer who also wants to apply something similar. While their documents are in tendering, they don't want to update because the carriers are kind of have a non-TM system, a non-SAP TM system, so legacy system that cannot handle changes. And for a short period until they also upgrade to the TM, they cannot receive any updates while the tendering is in process. And that's why they also stop it, but that's a bit of custom development and
and this is a specific implementation for a specific action. So this kind of trigger will be created only for one action. I think this is the update from related tour. So in this case, only one specific trigger ID will be visible for such documents in the tables.
Maybe based on the trigger ID, we can check which objects in TM use this trigger concept. You mentioned the TOR, but besides TOR, other business objects can also use in standard this concept.
Yes, currently the trigger concept is used mainly for TOR and TRQ documents, but also for schedules, allocations. I've seen some IDs. I think there are around 30 or 35 different trigger IDs. If you're interested in to find out for which purpose one trigger ID is used, then the best way is to do a where used on the trigger ID in the constant interface.
Which constant interface is it?
It's the trigger constant interface.
Okay.
STMTMS IF trig C.
With underscore between.
As far as I remember, also the Chaco, the process controller, uses this concept
Chaco
as well.
Is a little bit a special case because the Chaco currently is the only trigger ID that doesn't refer to an action but to a function module, because the implementation of the change controller has been done by a function module. So this is not so nice for the trigger report, because the trigger report there's the main item is a trigger, and it has to retrieve from the context all the information about that trigger. So only when retrieving the context from this trigger, it realizes that now it has to call a function module instead of an action, and this makes it not so nice in the implementation of the trigger report. So basically, everything what is there in the trigger report is there in two versions: one version for actions and one version for function modules. So, for example, when doing maintenance, you always have to keep in mind if you do a correction in one area, there's a high probability that you have to do it a second time for the function module version. But this is
more for us, huh?
So legacy. Yeah, it's also interfaces of function modules behave a little bit differently than interfaces of than the parameter structures of actions when doing all this internal handling. Yeah. But change controller is a very prominent example. So this is because usage of the change controller can lead to mass updates of different documents in the system. So this is a good candidate for creating triggers.
Ah, the change controller is a good candidate for another podcast episode then. But okay, that's...
We already had the process controller
episode,
so we touched this already. But another thing that comes to my mind is it's not only that you can create triggers for business objects, but you can even create triggers for nodes of a business object. So for example, in the Tor object, we have a trigger ID that refers to an update of a Tor stub. So even that is possible because if you have an action in your model that operates on a specific node of an object, not on the root node necessarily, then of course for the trigger report or the trigger concept, this doesn't matter. It's just a key. And in the context, you store to which node you refer to.
This gives us a plug. One, maybe the big example for that is the time propagation for freight units, right? Because we have freight unit stages can be planned in parallel, which means the stops and stop successors can be locked separately. So I can plan the pre-leg and the on carriage or main carriage in principle in parallel. And of course, this can lead to the time conflict, basically. So if I'm very optimistic on the pre-leg and on the main carriage, then I have a good chance that I have a time conflict afterwards. But still, we have the requirement that that those stages can be planned separately. So we have to handle that. And that's also done with that report. And that is then on stage level or technically stop level, where we do the locking and then also the action where we check if we now have a time conflict or not. That's another candidate where we have quite some entries sometimes in the trigger table, I think. Okay, I think that's okay for how to create triggers. But I think we only create them to get rid of them again with that report. So maybe we can go a bit deeper on that report side. So
already mentioned, the report should be scheduled as a background job frequently, proposal every 10 minutes, with a standard variant. And the default variant is, I think, we added in the last few months a few selection parameters for this report in the consulting note that is mentioned in the application operations guide. I wrote down in which support package for which release we added which selection parameter. For example, one selection parameter is the package size. This package size parameter is quite old. What has been changed is that the default value has been set to 1,000, I think. Previously, it was initial empty. So the meaning of this package size is that we try to process not more than 1,000 triggers before we do a commit. This allows reducing runtimes because the buffers involved don't grow too much. In case of an error, we are not forced to roll back everything. It's a parameter. If you you have to play around with it if you think this is required. The default 1,000 is
Of scientific research, we found that 1,000 exactly to be very good default.
I was a little bit vague about that we try to process not many more than 1,000 entries. the situation is a little bit more complicated because, as I mentioned in the beginning, we try to process triggers as in a way how they have been created by the original action. So let's say, for example, we have again our 100 freight order example, which we try to change coming from a POWL action for a freight order, for a forwarding order, for example. Let's assume we have already, the packet size is 1,000, the default value. We have already processed 950 triggers. And now we hit the first entry of this 100 freight orders. So we have the choice either we process only the first 50 freight orders because the package size is 1,000, or we keep our original idea and do what should have been done originally. And this is the way we followed. In that case, we will take all the 100 triggers belonging to the same context, process them, and then apply the package size. So we realize then, after we applied the 100 triggers for the freight orders with the same context, we realize we process now 1,050 freight orders. This is bigger than 1,000, or at least as big as 1,000. Then we apply the package size. So this means in some cases we will exceed the package size, but let's say not much. This is one selection parameter. There's another important selection parameter which might be used mainly for support activities. This is the restriction to a certain trigger ID. So there is a select option available for the trigger ID. So if you have an issue with one specific trigger ID, then you can select that trigger ID. Default, of course, is all trigger IDs.
In such a way, you can influence the sequence. Somehow,
for example,
of the triggers.
Yes, the standard sequence, I think, is the alphabetical order of the trigger ID in the S database table, which is, yeah.
What else could it be?
another important selection parameter that has been introduced in a support package for all releases is the timestamp. The trigger header table contains the timestamp of creation time in UTC time zone. And with that, this is a range selection option. You can select, for example, just if it happens in a not so important test system that you didn't schedule the background report from the very beginning.
No, that can't happen, Thomas.
If you realize that, you have already several thousand triggers because the report was never executed, then you can restrict the selection on based on this creation timestamp. So, for example, you already know that the freight orders from last year are completed and maybe you missed the pending action, but anyway, now it doesn't help anymore. So you want to process only the triggers created in the last 2 weeks. You can select those triggers based on their creation timestamp. Unfortunately, currently there is no option to get rid of the other triggers easily, but yeah, that's the current status. So if you're interested only in the latest triggers, then please use the timestamp range selection.
Okay. I think there are also some parameters like process in case of errors, kind of thing. Should we?
This is a radio button option. So the standard the variant is the normal processing. Take any trigger that is there on the database table and try to process it. Okay. For historical reasons, there are other ways to use that. For example, one variant enables you to mark entries for which you get an error during processing. This is a flag or a letter R or E, I don't remember exactly, which is stored after processing, after finishing the report. This is stored on the database table just to allow you in the next run to delete those entries. I haven't seen any usage of this variant. The issue is that you need to be able to catch an error. Okay. And since you a trigger can call an arbitrary action in the system, you never know whether you can catch an error or not. The system might, there might be errors that they will simply get a dump, and of course then this variant also doesn't help.
Yeah.
But this was the main idea. If you can catch an error from your action, you can store that information in the trigger itself, and then you check the document itself and realize, oh, I don't need this update anymore, and then you can, by a different variant, you can run the trigger reports in a way that it deletes these marked triggers.
I mean, that's a good point. Are we complete with that report, or is there something more? Ah, maybe there's one thing. You said you run that report. I think normally you would schedule it, right?
Yes.
And maybe one thing, I think pretty normal in SAP landscape, but you should not use a named user for that. So if you schedule typically a report, okay, somebody has to do it, but then you would schedule it for a system user or something, or a batch user or something. And that's the first thing. So don't use a named user, because what happens then, this user leaves the project, the user is locked, and nobody looks at that report. And from the moment on, the user disappears from the system. Of course, the system, the batch report would stop working, because that user does not exist in the system anymore. So you have something like a batch user or so. And we have in TM, that's a bit specific.
It's the same for all scheduled jobs.
That is totally true. And that's also the same is true for all TM jobs or for that kind of users. We have a special authorization like TM all, which basically forces the authority check to leave more or less directly. So you can assign then to that kind of batch users that special authorization. And to be on the very safe side, you also have to activate something in a little body that you really want to do that for security reasons. We are a bit defensive on that one, but then that processing is also way faster, because for that specific user, he's just allowed to do anything in TM with that special authorization. We can also, I forgot the node number, which brings that and explains a bit on that. We can also add that to the show notes, then that specific super TM super authorization. I think besides that, report, there are also other ways to process triggers, right? So if I have a certain document and I want to be sure that all the triggers are processed for the document, maybe I don't want to go to the report and run it for all triggers, but maybe come more from the document side.
Yeah, well, this is not exactly right, that there is no standard way of executing those triggers, but there is an action that allows you to process triggers for a specific document. This is currently implemented only for the Tor root. Mm-hmm. So you remember, you can have triggers for any node in one of your BO models, but this specific action is available only for the Tor root node. And this action is simply there. So as a customer, you can use it, for example, and well, I think this is the main idea where we might even sometime use it in standard. For example, when you want to send a freight order to ERP to create a shipment, this is one of the two scenarios for our shipment integration.
Anton, this one's not for you. Huh?
it's quite important that this freight order is up to date. So for example, if you have a pending trigger for this freight order that reassigns the freight unit from an order-based transportation requirement to a delivery-based transportation requirement, you cannot send the freight order to ERP before, because in this action, sending it to ERP, there is a check whether all freight orders already refer to delivery-based transportation requirements. So if you lock your freight order and you get the update from ERP that creates the delivery-based transportation requirement, and you don't propagate this change to the freight order, you cannot send the freight order as a shipment to ERP. So Now, if a user wants to send this freight order as a shipment to ERP from the UI, he will get the error message. I don't remember completely. It's something, action not enabled or something like that. So in that case, if you don't want to wait for the next run of the trigger report in background, you have the possibility to run this specific new action that processes the triggers for this document before sending your document to ERP. And this will then enable the action because the freight order then refers only to delivery-based transportation requirements.
Can you also call that action somewhere from the UI, like POW or something?
Currently, there is no action on the UI, but yeah, this would be an easy development. Maybe we have to convince one of our product owners to create a backlog item for it.
Or do a secret development.
Maybe regarding the performance of this trigger report, as far as I remember, this trigger report also locks the documents.
Yes.
And excludes those triggers which cannot be logged.
Yeah, there is a.
It's
a good point. Yeah, and it was a decision whether we should lock all the triggers in the very beginning, or we should wait until the action is called. And we decided we will try to lock as many documents from the very beginning because we realized that otherwise we would create too many triggers by the trigger report itself, because when an action is called, the action typically doesn't know anymore whether it's called from the trigger report or from a UI action, for example. So what the trigger report does internally, it tries to lock as many objects as possible in the beginning. And if it can't lock any object, then it ignores it completely. So it leaves the trigger without touching it further. So this was part of one performance improvement where we had quite a few the last 1-2 years, and but since the situation is so generic, it can be a disadvantage in certain situations. You never know, but our assumption is that in average this should help.
Maybe that's a good point in time for a small sidestep about locking and BOP. I think that's also for those of you that develop a bit in TM space, if you have an action and you just call it action ignoring locking in the first place, and then this action does a modification from within the coding, which is typically what an action does, right? So you call a root action, customer root action, and then you modify a customer root field in your action. If now Bob finds out, okay, now I have an update to the document and then runs into a locking issue, so somebody else locked that document externally, you get a dump. So if you have a customer action, you have to make sure that you have the so-called lock nodes for that action set correctly in BOP. So now if you create an action, you enter the class name, etc. And I think on the second tab or somewhere, you define what are the nodes that you plan to lock with that action. And that's not just a loose recommendation or a nice to have thing. You have to set that because otherwise you get very strange dumps because to be very precise, that dump is not in a point of time when you've write the modification, but when the modification is processed. And then you can enjoy finding that place, which is the next end modify. For example, if it goes back to the UI, so you have your action, then 5 other actions, and then an end modify comes, and then it dumps, and then find out that you, with your action, are the guilty one. So that's why it's very important if you have your own action created in BOP, think about what are the nodes that I will change. For example, if I have the root node, I have as a write node the root node, but it can also be a different node. For example, I technically that action is on the stop level, but I know that I also will update the root node. Then you have to have 2 write nodes, the stop node and the root node. Yeah? Because then if the action is called and Bob will check beforehand if it can lock, and if not, you have failed keys in the action, but that's at least a defined situation then. And that's also how we do that enqueuing that. So yeah, maybe just a bit of a sidestep, but still maybe important to know, because that those dumps are really ugly, because it's in the end modifier. You don't know why, who wrote that entry that now has a locking issue. So it's always a good idea to lock before you code, so to say. Okay. Okay. So, anything more? Maybe, yeah. One small thing, maybe, because we just run over it. Upgrades, right? So maybe some of you may upgrade now from 8.0, 8.1 or something to 9.0, or more likely now 9.1, as we are now in GA already. Yeah, maybe some.
I mean, of course, the recommendation is since triggers are only a temporary entity, because they are usually created only when a document is locked, you should try to remove all triggers before you do an upgrade, for example, because of course you don't lock any documents anymore when you do an upgrade. And the first thing with the new system is schedule the background shop for trigger processing, and the last thing before you upgrade is you run the report again, because then it should clear the trigger table and all documents will be in sync before you have a clean upgrade. Otherwise, what could theoretically happen is that interfaces of actions or function modules change from one release to the other, and retrieving context data might get complicated. So the recommendation is clear the trigger table by running the background job one last time before you do an upgrade. This is a nice end of a system's lifetime.
Maybe we can touch shortly the enhancement question. Is it possible for the customer to enhance something in this concept, introduce new triggers or something like this? You mentioned this table is S.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Table for the trigger IDs is an S table, so it's not supposed to be enhanced by customer. No, the table is not just supposed to be enhanced, but the customer should also not create new entries for this table. What a customer can do, of course, can reuse existing trigger IDs if it refers to a suitable action. So, for example, I already mentioned that it's not exactly a one-to-one relationship between a trigger ID and the action. So we have trigger IDs that serve two or three actions because they are very similar. So this, of course, can be also done by a customer. In that way, we make sure that we have all the constants available, for example.
And I think the typical use case we have is you also want to update a follow-up document. So you want to copy something through or so. And in that case, I think it's just a good idea as kind of a surf on the existing stuff. So maybe just enhance the action update if it's about TORs, update from related TORs, which is the action which is always called if you run into a lock or locking issue when propagating data changes from the predecessor to the successor. So you can then use standard technologies to enhance this update from related TORs action, which is always called if a predecessor document has been changed. So in that case, you don't have to think about setting the trigger and creating a trigger ID or so. But if you have other use cases where you have to think and you need that specifics, then you should follow what Thomas mentioned. So create your own
In some sense, it's always an update of a follow-up document, because a trigger is only created when you have a locked document. And if you try to perform an action, which propagation of which fails because of another locked document, then this is some kind of a follow-up for another document. And this can be a TOR, a TOR root, or a TOR stop. It can be a TRQ root. It can be a schedule or whatever. Mm. And for all, well, maybe not for all, but for all cases we are aware of, we already have trigger IDs for it. So currently we don't see requirement to create new trigger IDs, but yeah, there are more convenient ways to achieve that.
Okay, longer than we thought again.
So maybe in the end, for all the consultants out there, it's not that hard. Just schedule the trigger report and it will do all the job. There's nothing you have to worry about once you have it
running.
Yeah.
In the best case, whenever you download the TM software, you read first the application operations guide.
Of course you do.
You read that you have to schedule the background job before you create any document or start with your customizing or whatever.
And it's not only that job you have to schedule, right? There are also other important jobs which are not covered yet by an episode, like location deletions. And there are other kind of cleanup report or housekeeping reports which are needed. And then they are all mentioned in the application.
One paragraph for which lists all these jobs that have to be scheduled. And in the best case, then forget about triggers. If you observe, I mean, some customers do that, they observe growth of database tables, then the table for the trigger headers is the one which should make you think about the trigger concept. And in that case, it's important, or it might be helpful, to check the trigger ID that is affected. Usually this is then one trigger ID that is responsible for the growth. But you have to start analyzing. Since this concept is so generic, there is no general recommendation what to do. It always depends on the action.
Nice closing words. Goodbye. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the trigger report. Do not forget about it. But then once scheduled, you can forget about it, basically, right?
You should.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.